This is WGXC 90.7 FM local, which is ACRA, Hudson, Catskill, and we're also global, streaming live at WGXC.org. And this is The Art of the Hudson Valley. I'm your host, Chad Weckler, and we have two guests in the studio today, Robert and Shanna Park Harrison. They happen to have an exhibition at the Center for Photography at Woodstock in 2 days, on Saturday, November 5th. Runs for 2 months, which is fantastic. So you get a lot of opportunity to see that exhibition of photographs. And welcome to the studio, Robert and Shanna.
Thank you very much for having us.
Yeah, thanks for inviting us.
Well, my pleasure. And we've met for the first time just before we went on the air. And you're not quite Hudson Valley residents, but you're a bit north, but in Saratoga area.
We live in Saratoga, but we kind of consider ourselves a bit more at home down here because we lived for many, many years in South Egremont, which is, you know, kind of still in this neighborhood.
Yeah, just over the border.
Exactly.
And before we get into talking about your, well, I call you both artists, if you don't mind, because you're showing photographs, but you're more than photographers. And to sort of give our listening audience a little bit more background, Shanna, I'm going to ask you, when did you find out you liked being an artist, or you found out that you wanted to be an artist?
Well, I think I always knew that I wanted to be in the arts. I started out as a dancer, a classical ballet dancer, and spent most of my young life doing that. But my dad was an interior designer, so I was always around drawing and painting and thinking about the creative process. And so when I went to college, I decided that I was going to make a switch and not major in dance, but I wanted to major in painting. So I did that. And that sort of led me to my next career, which was working at an art school where I met Bob.
Ah. And Bob, when did the art bug find you?
Probably when I was really young. I've always really enjoyed drawing and painting. And I had a grandfather who passed away just before I was born, who I was able to have a lot of his sketchbooks and a lot of his paintings to look at. And I would find myself copying them or using his tools, his brushes and things like that. And my mother is also an artist, so I've always had that in my family, even though I grew up actually in a military family. So my father was a colonel, and yet he was very supportive too. So that was quite nice. And so I never thought of myself doing anything else other than pursuing a life as an artist and trying to figure out how to make that happen. And I always thought that I was going to be a painter and went to art school thinking that, you know, I'd work on large canvases, maybe more traditional sense of an artist. And it wasn't until, you know, being in art school that I was introduced to working with all kinds of alternative cameras, like pinhole cameras and Holga cameras and ways to manipulate reality using photography. And to me, that was a really amazing way of thinking about imagery, the way in which you could use the kind of realness of photography, but you could really manipulate it like a painter. And so I think that's really continued in our work even today.
And when the two of you met, did you start collaborating immediately?
Not immediately. Bob was finishing up at the Kansas City Art Institute, but when we left Kansas City and we moved to the Southwest, we sort of didn't have a lot of choice but to begin to collaborate. We were both doing different things artistically, but because we were in grad school, we sort of needed each other's help, and it sort of came naturally to help each other. And because Bob started out on a trajectory towards constructed photography and using himself in the images, it became sort of a natural thing for me to become the photographer and the director in terms of when we were actually shooting photos. So we fell into it, but it became for us, it was probably in 1995 when we figured out, it actually takes both of us to make these images.
Yeah. And what was the first major project that both of you worked on together?
Well, I think
Bob's graduate exhibition.
This is true. Definitely. Yeah, I think that when we did find ourselves working together, I kind of see it going back even further, probably early 90s even. When, like Shanna was saying, I was interested in this constructive photography way of working, and then not having much success using other people as a model or a character in the work. And so I just, I was always around, so it was easy enough for me to become a figure in the work. And I think that Shanna saw quickly that I was having such difficulty trying to be a subject in the photograph and then also setting it up and making the shot happen and often not even being in the frame. And she would say, let me just get behind the camera and handle this. And it became much more than just Shanna pushing the button. It became, in a way, she was like a director. And it is a process of choreography that happens when we're working together. And she's behind the camera directing me and positioning me in different ways to evoke different kinds of narratives and ideas that kind of fire off and happen as we're working in this pretty organic process.
And I've also seen both of you in the same image. So that's pretty cool where, and sometimes it's Shanna and often it's you, Robert, that is the subject. Do you ever use anybody else?
We use our daughter. Oftentimes there are a few photographs that I have been in, but for the most part, it's actually our daughter. So, I mean, I know I look that young that you would that you would make that mistake, but for almost always the female in the imagery would be our younger daughter, and she's adult enough now that it doesn't look like she's a kid in the photographs. We've used a few other people. We tend to use people that are close to us, that are aware of exactly what we're attempting to evoke with regard to all of our imagery. We find that actors sometimes, if they don't know our work, then they don't understand what we're really asking them to do. And so we feel like they're acting. And so it's easier for us to just use people who hear us talking about our work and understand the concepts that we're dealing with.
Well, maybe this is a perfect time to, in word, try and describe an image that you do create. And I know you've been one project that's been a long time where you've been working on is The Architect's Brother. And maybe you could talk about one of those images or any one of the images that, because what you do is you have props that you make, you almost use a collage aspect of creating an image. So Robert, maybe you could talk about the process and what you're trying to convey with the photograph.
Yeah, so that body of work, which was several years in the making, and I think that this overriding idea that we were interested in was to create a kind of alternative world through photographs and to construct a sort of reality or story or even film about this kind of anonymous characters. Some people have referred to this figure in the work, which is me in the images, as a kind of everyman, which I'm not quite sure. I mean, I understand why that term is used, but we tend to call him a kind of constant protagonist. But so what it is that figure in the work is really a stand-in for humanity, and we really want the viewer to almost see themselves through that character. And so in the images, he tries to perform these various tasks to somehow jumpstart this world that he lives in, that's very very much without other people and not really much nature either. It's kind of this place that is a bit apocalyptic, and it's also sort of ancient and futuristic at the same time. So it's very timeless, and in some images it feels kind of old, and you don't quite know where this place is. And it pretty much stemmed from the influence of the book The Little Prince, and that story, that child's story, that you know, about that single young character who has to take care of this planet that he lives on. And it, in a sense, it's kind of a metaphor for, you know, our existence today, you know, taking care of the planet and being a steward to the landscape. And so, you know, through each image, through each little series in that body of work, it just built on itself over time. And I think that we started to find that it was such a tight-knit narrative way of working that we became, in a way, kind of workers to the narrative, and that was really an enjoyable place to be for several years.
And there's in some of your work there is the fantasy inventor. One of my favorite images is the man opening up the earth to adjust gears that are just under the surface. And it's just a beautiful image, but what does it mean to you? Why did you create that image?
I think that image came at a time when we were living in Worcester, Massachusetts, where there are there's this sense of history and old factories and mill buildings and things like that, that it has that real connection to the Industrial Revolution. And so with that image, it's turning to spring. It's so he's torn open the earth, and underneath that are all of these cogs and gears and things, and he's using this very large wrench to somehow tighten or to change back or somehow have a sense of control of the balance of nature. But it's really a futile image. And he looks very tired, and it's a very gray, kind of melancholy, kind of, you know, ridiculous act to do. So,
But it sounds like that's the Little Prince.
Yes, right. Taking on something bigger than himself and not quite ever achieving it necessarily, or making a strong attempt to doing that. But futility is definitely at the heart of our work, and failure and all of those kind of elements of what it is to live in our world, and in the sense of human condition, this facing of constant struggle that we always seem to be battling.
and when the two of you, Shannon, when you're working together on coming up with an idea, I'm sure there's just a discussion in the beginning of, you know, what do you want to do now? How does that process work?
Well, we work possibly differently than most photographers in that we don't take one photograph at a time. We work in bodies of work. Each body could have between 12 and 15 images. And so the process for getting to the point of having 12 to 15 images, we actually do a large amount of research and conversation kind of the idea of throwing the ball back and forth at each other until we get closer and closer and closer to a set of ideas. But we will take on information, ideas from a previous body of work, and we'll decide that there's elements that we want to pursue further. And that's sort of the seed for a new series. And so the series will begin with a lot of research in a library, typically. In theaters, we watch a lot of movies. We watch a lot of theater and dance productions. We'll each read sometimes things separately, as well as maybe throw articles back and forth to each other. We basically go into a period of time where we are completely immersed in the conversation and completely immersed in opening ourselves up to learning a huge variety of things all within a set period of time. It can be anything from politics to science related to religion to things that are going on in the other art forms. And so all of that information kind of gets put into the pot all at once, and ideas begin to come to the top. And we start out by sketching those ideas. So it could be a huge, could be two or three sketchbooks that are full of ideas, visual ideas. And we start putting those ideas together and honing them and creating what will eventually be 12 to 15 images. At that point, there's a lot of conversation. Our daughter will say, you know, it goes on 24 hours a day. So we just start narrowing down the options, and then we start looking for landscapes. And from that, we start building props, start finding things. We start scavenging for objects that we can use within the props. And then we start photographing. We actually, as photographers, we don't take a lot of photographs. We actually spend most of our time building up the ideas before we ever pick up a camera.
And putting all those elements together, that's a large process too.
Yes. Yes. We spend a lot of time constructing what we think the image is going to look like. We build all of the props. We find the landscapes. And then we get out there and we find that we were totally wrong and that we have to go back to square one again, or maybe square five. And we have to think on the fly when we're out in the field, and maybe something interesting happens when we're actually on the set that completely changes the entire idea of the image. And we're open to that. We're fine with that.
Robert, do you have a favorite sequence of images that you've put together, or are they all your children and you love them equally?
I don't know.
Definitely there are certain images, I think, not so much series, but maybe specific images that are special to us or to each of us individually. And it may be on a level, and I'm thinking of one or two right now that are coming to mind as you just mentioned that, but they're generally those kind of images that you feel as though you went pretty far with that particular idea, and maybe it's not quite resolved. It's those kind of images that kind of haunt you or maybe lead you to something to make in the future. You know, they sort of point the way to another possibility to do something else that's connected to that in some way. Because our work, you know, we, as Shanna described it, it's a very obsessive process, and it's so much about working ourselves into a state of mind where we have this kind of heightened awareness of taking in influence and stimulation, but also tapping into this kind of intuitive, archetypal kind of stream that is I think within all of us as individuals, as people, but that kind of creative sourcing, and it's so fleeting, you know, you can stay there for only so long and then it kind of dries up and you have to keep kind of filling that well to draw upon. But yeah, so we spent so much time, you know, not so much in the camera working, but, you know, with this intensive kind of research, drawing and dialogue. And yeah, there's a certain images that somehow you feel that strong connection. Mm. And generally they're the ones that were probably the most difficult to make, or at other times they were the most spontaneous images. It's so strange. The creative process, I find, is so fascinating and so mysterious and strange and odd. it's very unexplainable. And
for you, is it performance art?
Yes. I mean, that's something I've been interested in for a long time. And in fact, you know, this idea of theater and acting was something I was interested in when I was younger, but I just didn't want to be up on stage in front of people. I really liked the behind the scenes and all of the sets and things like that were more interesting to me. But when I was in graduate school, my first year, I took a course in performance art just because I thought, you know, that's a really interesting idea to make art out of action or using the body. And the idea that it's so ephemeral and live. And I think that connection to performance, movement, and using the body has just been kind of constant in our work, but also the things that we enjoy seeing as well, which is dance and theater. But to use yourself in your work, I really enjoy being part of the artistic medium to physically being part of the actual work itself is a kind of cathartic experience for me personally. It's my way of connecting to performance art, even though it's not live. It's live before the camera and us, but we generally work just between Shannon and I. We very seldom ever have somebody helping us, and that's just, I think, having a sense of, I don't know, being free to just do what we do and not have to worry about other people sort of hanging around watching. I think that we'd be making different work.
Well, someone described some of your images as stills from a movie, or there's motion, there's a moment in time that's captured. It's not just a still life. It's almost, if there was action before, then there's your image and there's going to be action afterwards.
Oh, I'm glad you say that. Well, I mean, that's something that we're always thinking about. Mm. Yes, that kind of sliced narrative. So it has that ambiguity of not knowing before or after is really interesting to us. That kind of image that has that sort of energy and mystery is really important to us.
But I think it also has to do with our desire for viewers to place themselves in the work. And because people tend to be so enamored with film and sort of lose themselves in watching films, we wanted to play with that idea. We wanted to have that. It's not necessarily a heightened moment in terms of being a heroic moment. It could be on the cusp of failure as well. Hmm. But it always asks you to look forward and to look back so that you see the action before you as placed in time. And that, yeah, so that gives it the look of being from something cinematic.
And you were mentioning before about failure. There's almost an often futile action in some of these imageries. It's like, it's sorry, buddy, it doesn't look good for you, or you know, you're.
Right.
But then there are still very illustrative moments in time which are not like that. And what's the series that has involving the circus? Because those are are different, I think, from some of your other works.
I think that's probably what you're referring to is maybe more recent images, because that is something that
is it decisive.
Well, there's a series called Gautier's Dream, which is highly theatrical, but then some of our most recent work from the series Precipice also has kind of a carnival quality to it. Basically, all of our imagery, regardless of the series, is based on our inquiry into the relationship between humans and technology and nature. And so we ebb and flow throughout those subjects and how they relate to each other. It's a bit of the guiding force. It's always present, no matter what else might be part of a series. So an earlier series, say one of the Architect's Brother series, was highly influenced by inventors such as Edison and Da Vinci. And so even though it was about the environment, even though it was about this person's relationship to the environment, it was about inventors as well. So there's always, you know, another theme that flows through a series of images.
Yeah, and then we have this body of work. It's two bodies of work that are all based in using color. And that work, I think, really grew out of when we lived over in the Berkshires. We lived in the country, and we had 5 acres, and we felt a real close connection to the environment and just, you know, working out in all kinds of locations around that area. And looking at painting, thinking of, you know, Pre-Raphaelite painting or even color-filled painting, and using color film or color digital imagery, which is really different than all of this early black and white work that we're doing with Architect's Brother. And then after that, for the last, I don't know, 6 years, we've lived in a whole different place, much more in a town and up in Saratoga. And we haven't connected to the landscape. We've been very much working inside our studio and inventing spaces, and somehow have arrived at, you know, this kind of fascination with theatrics and illusion and this element of circusy carnival kind of imagery. And I think it's probably just an exploration into a different kind of terrain or landscape. Some of the images, I think, are a little bit more cynical in some ways, and playing with black humor and I don't know, kind of illusions and theatrics and this idea of just all elements of the theater.
Your work also reminds me of illustrators from the late 19th century into the mid 20th century that didn't use photography, but they used pen and ink and to do fantasy. Jules Verne almost meets Edgar Allan Poe kind of work. And that was a very special time, I think, in illustration, which we often don't see anymore. So you've brought that back in a different medium with photography. And you were mentioning earlier when you weren't using digital, were you using paper negatives?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
All of the Architect's Brother work, up until 2005, everything was made in the dark room. So all of the illusion that I think today somewhat loses its context, because people can look at our images from the 90s up to 2005, and it's very easy to assume that those things, those illusions, were made in Photoshop, and they weren't. It's all kind of a process. I think it comes out of the fact that we really both see ourselves as painters, so we construct images, so we shoot many, many different aspects of a final image, and we put them together in the dark room, and then we actually have a process of within paper negatives where we're drawing both in darks and lights on the negatives in order to enhance the overall construction of an image. And then, in fact, once the photograph is deemed complete, it's actually not complete because we then paint on it. Mm. So in many ways, we don't see ourselves as photographers in the traditional sense because we're thinking of the image that we're going to create before we ever think about picking up a camera.
Were the early images one of a kinds?
They were. The work from the early 90s up until 1997, those images tended to be very large and they were very painterly and they were one of a kinds. And then we started using the paper negative process in around 1997, actually more to our advantage, because what was happening was we would make images and they would sell, which was great because we could use the money, but they were going to collectors and so we didn't have access to them in order to be in exhibitions. So we decided to use the paper negative process to our advantage and actually kind of, as photographers, make more than one print. So we started making small editions. Normally, the Architect's Brother editions would be done in maybe an edition of four or five. And even though there were differences between each and every one of those images, they would, for the most part, look the same. The painting would set it apart, one to the next. And then when we switched over and started doing color work for the series Grey Dawn and Counterpoint, which there are some of those images in the show in Woodstock as well, though many of those images were then one-of-a-kind paintings as well. They were large, very large, so we chose to make those only once.
Speaking of CPW, did you curate that show, or did they?
Well, we let Hannah know all of the work that we would have available for her to choose from, and then she put it together.
Cool.
Yeah, so, and then she came up to our studio, and we spent a few hours, you know, going through it, and yeah, we really just allowed her to pick and choose, and we gave some feedback, but yeah, that was nice.
And is that always the case with exhibitions that you've been in, except for group shows?
Yeah.
No, yeah. I mean, it varies. Like, if we do we've been kind of lucky. If we do an exhibition, a solo exhibition, it's often that we choose exactly what we get to show. Mm. But it just depends. I mean, sometimes there are constraints, and we have to listen to the other person, and that's fine too. It's great.
Yeah, the ideal way I think for us to work is to you know, work towards that solo show when we know what space it's going to be in, and we think about that quite a bit. That starts to put into play, you know, when we think about scale and where pieces will be placed in a space, and that interaction with a viewer. That's really that's really ideal. Love doing that. So,
was there an exhibition of your props?
There was an exhibition that included the props. Mm. When we had a traveling exhibition with the George Eastman House, of a large number of the Architect's Brother, we call them paintings, a large number of the Architect's Brother images. And for a couple of those exhibitions, I believe at the George Eastman House in Rochester and then at the De Cordova in Lincoln, Massachusetts, right outside of Boston, in both of those cases, we had some of the props in the show. And then we decided that we were, first of all, they were taking on a lot of wear and tear, and we weren't ready to stop using them. So we pulled all of the props, and it actually led to an interesting process that we took on in 2007. We were given a grant, and this particular grant is called the Nancy Graves Grant, and we, when you receive it as a mid-career artist, you are supposed to do something outside of your medium. And so we decided that what we wanted to do was to make three-dimensional objects, to make sculptures that were no longer props, that were really just objects that stood on their own and were completely aligned with our photography. So it was nice for us to finally have to think about props as actual sculptures, and that allowed us to sort of break the tension that had been building up for quite some time in terms of wanting to make something that was important enough to stand on its own.
And one of the props that, and maybe you use this often, and I don't know if it's physical or collaged together, are some of the shoes that I've seen that are quite lengthy, long, almost like wingtip shoes with the point, yeah. And it seems to be like 2 feet long. Is it 2 feet long?
It's 3 feet long. And those are real. Those are an actual sculpture that came out of the Nancy Graves Fellowship. Those are called Shoes for Pan. And they're very, as I said, very long shoes. When we did the Nancy Graves Fellowship, we decided to work with people that were actually technically capable of making sculptures. So we worked with a welder, we worked with a shoemaker, and we worked with a person doing some bronze casting. So the shoemaker that we worked with is out of Holyoke, Massachusetts, and she attended RISD, and then she became a shoemaker, and it was wonderful to collaborate with her because, first of all, I think she was thrilled. She was able to make shoes that weren't really wearable. That was exciting for her. But we made three different sculptures with her. It was great.
And is it Edison's Light that you're on a sort of a bicycle, but it's only the hub and the spokes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of like a unicycle in a way.
Now, yeah. Is that a real prop?
It is, yes. Yeah, and it's actually the size so I could actually sit on it. It doesn't move, so it's actually on a stand. So I'm just standing there. Well, I'm sitting there on it, acting like I'm pedaling the action. And then I have a big light bulb in the back of my on my back.
Yes.
With all of these wires and then a kind of lightning rod helmet on. So I'm racing towards that lightning bolt that's striking the mountain. Oh, and then I also have two glasses of water, one in each hand, and they're my arms are suspended on these wooden structure scaffolding things. So yeah, it's a pretty ridiculous apparatus that I'm on.
Well, it's like Edison meets Benjamin Franklin, mm-hmm. Meets Jules Verne kind
yeah.
of thing.
Oh, yeah, that, all that you know. Mushed together, right, exactly. Yeah, book that I've always loved, and I think about often when constructing things or building props would be Frankenstein, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, oh. And that whole story and the descriptions of the laboratory and all of those ways in which that character was trying to create life. It just was so fascinating, the descriptions in that narrative. Yeah.
Also, yeah. When we in 1995 when we first left graduate school, we were at the Roswell Artist in Residence program in Roswell, New Mexico. And at the museum in Roswell, they have the original studio for
Robert Goddard,
who was the American father of rocketry. Mm-hmm. And what was so interesting, and I think had a lot of influence on the way we make props, is that you could see in Goddard's studio that, you know, even though he made rockets that went up in the air and blew up, he was basically using duct tape and these ridiculous discarded electronic parts, and it was so makeshift.
They were very sculptural.
They're wonderful.
These little rocket motors and explosives and things like that.
But yeah. It was all very handmade. It was really wonderful to see. And I think oftentimes that's how we make the props that we make. And it's almost always true that only one side of the prop is completed to perfection. The other side is a complete shambles. It's just for the camera.
Just like Hollywood.
There you go.
Well, and they're also made out of found objects. I mean, we're wanting to use things and tear them apart. Machines that we find or pieces of furniture, things like that, that have that kind of makeshift, repurposed sort of quality, the found object playing a part in our work and working from the function of what that object was used for before and giving it a kind of new meaning and function to us is a really interesting way of using materials that have a previous meaning or use to them.
Could you envision yourselves doing animation or film?
Yes, definitely. And in fact, we've recently played around with that a bit and it would be, I think, really interesting to work with movement, time-based processes in our work, or because we're always building just for that one still and implying function and movement, but to think about, yes, that's like time-based. But I think it's always kind of comes down to it's so difficult that I think we would need to collaborate to do that, because we're just not, we just can't find enough time in the day to do to pull all that together. So,
but more than that, I think we both are interested in collaborating with dancers, theater, opera, because so much of the way we make our images is sort of the way puppet shows get made and the way theater gets made. Mm-hmm. You know, it's all about illusion. So I think that we feel most at home in that element. Also because Bob had some experience acting and I was a dancer. So we actually are doing we're sort of on a long-term collaboration with a dance company out of Boston. We're going to go into our third artist in residence with them in the spring. And that's really interesting because we get to see our art come to life, but we don't have to worry about the technology necessarily. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be that our art is perfectly aligned with the use in a theater.
And you would remain as directors in a sense.
Yes, there's more directors. I mean, we have the two artistic directors from the dance company, so there's four of us. So that seems to be working out pretty well.
And this company is Prometheus Dance. And they've been based in Boston for several years.
So besides the dance company that you're going to be continuing to work with, what's also on the palette for the future?
Oh, well, we just finished an exhibition in Chicago in the spring. And so we're now sort of in that incubation period of trying to figure out what the next project will be.
Yeah, that project, I think, took a lot out of us. In fact, it was so highly constructed in our studio that when we were making that work, it sort of fell into that time period. It was not last winter, but the winter before, that was so extreme that we just couldn't think of staging any images outside. It was so cold. So we just really held up in our studio and got to the point where we were so tired of working inside that we started to venture out and starting to think about actually staging things in real places and trying that out for a little while, which we're still playing around with and doing. So, you know, we might be traveling and have an anticipated site that we've researched to actually build something that will be photographed at that place. And that has a really interesting energy that we've never really tapped into. Since we've always invented, say, the world that, you know, the scene that we were going to photograph in this case, it's a bit out of our control. we have to deal with all those unexpected things that happen when you have an idea and you bring props and things and then you stage it, yet you don't know what the weather's going to be like. Yep. You don't know who's going to be standing around or even if you have access to that space until you get there. So there's a lot of this very spontaneous kind of reacting to it. And that's kind of an exciting place to be, to see where that goes.
And you're speaking of an environment that's not a forest or a desert. You're thinking of where people live, kind of a location?
Sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, the body of work that he's referring to that we've started on it's far more diverse in terms of its backdrop than say, The Architect's Brother. It's not just based in nature.
Yeah, it's based more in the everyday. And that's a really different place for us to be, and we're not sure where that's going to go. If it goes anywhere, you know, you kind of do these things where, you know, you work on them and you constantly are worried that it's just going to be a waste of time, right? But you have to do it. And you have to try. And that's how we've always worked. We just never know quite whether or not it's going to lead somewhere or not. But you just know that you have to keep reinventing things a little differently. I mean, we've always stayed pretty tight to our thread of work, which we've always been interested in, not veering too far away from this continuous narrative in our work. That's something we've tried to maintain, even working in color, but seeing where we can go, how far we can go outside of that without losing sense of that history of our work. Because we are a bit obsessed with our past, I think. We started making work pretty young, I think, and we received attention for our work when we were really young, and that was really special. But at the same time, you have this kind of history of what you've done. You can either just abandon that and not even think about that it's there, but for us, it is there. And so we work in this kind of very circular way. So ideas that maybe we explored 10 or so years ago still resonate with us, and we consider going back to those, but maybe in a little bit different way. So
it's not you're not ready to do like a whole 180, and like, for instance, change your color palette and your contrast palette, which there is a consistency that for the most part you do keep, although the mural images is different.
Yeah, it is different. The one you're talking about in the Worcester Art Museum, I believe, is what you're referring to. Yeah, it's one photograph that we worked on for well over a year. It's a very large photograph that's on this mural area of the Worcester Art Museum, the Renaissance Court. So it's been up for over 3 years now. And it definitely, it did have, it has a little different feel. It's in color and it's very Baroque. And I think that it still has our conceptual connections, but it is visually a bit of a different world. That piece actually led, I think, into what we were just doing currently. Most certainly.
Yeah,
much
with
more
doing
theatrical.
Doing the highly staged work. The piece at the Worcester Art Museum, it's definitely, while it's a visual departure from our work, it's definitely completely connected, because what we found was we were asked to respond to some of the work in the Worcester Art Museum, and the Worcester Art Museum is very well known for its antiquities from Antioch. And so what we ended up focusing on was some flooring from a very, very wealthy estate post earthquake. And so these mosaics that we were responding to really had a lot to do with how humans relate to nature, because these mosaics showed really barbaric hunts where people would go out and just for the thrill of killing would terrorize packs of animals and just slaughter all of them with absolutely no regard to the fact that they were going to not be capable of even eating half of what they had killed. So we decided that that, you know, people in Worcester had admired that piece for too long for the wrong reasons, and that we might want to point out that has a lot to do with human nature. It has a lot to do with how we as a culture use the environment, use nature and the earth to a point that might be abusive. So we definitely took that image and connected it within our work and connected it with the history and the mosaics at the museum. And ironically, even though we were pointing out something highly critical about this very famous piece, from what we hear, people in Worcester love the piece, so.
I hope so.
I hope so.
Would you say each project takes you a year at least?
No, I mean, when we did the Worcester Art Museum piece, it took a year, but we were doing other things as well. Mm. Many other things, but it was just a very large, massive logistical undertaking.
I think it's starting to length it out. I think it's more like 2 years now it takes us to do a project, but yeah. It does. It takes a lot longer.
And when you do work on a project, it's probably all that you do and think about, and you don't want to lose that train of thought and creativity.
Exactly.
Yeah. We don't do well juggling a lot of things at once. Yeah.
Well, you're multitasking even in the making of the image.
We're already multitasking, so we don't. Yeah. We try not to do much more of it. We often say that when we're deep into a project, okay, we can't answer the phone because we don't want to tell our friends no. We can't have dinner with you tonight, but we can't have dinner with them tonight. So, it's just it's sort of managing the focus, staying on top of it.
But thankfully, you do have a website.
We do.
And that's parkharrison.com.
That's right.
PARKEHARRISON. Where is all of your work there on the website, pretty much?
A lot of the work is there on the website. I mean, we may not have put every Architect's Brother piece up, but all of our work since 2005 is definitely on the website. Hmm.
And what are we going to be seeing at Woodstock for that exhibit?
That's going to be selected images from the Architect's Brother, along with, I think, 5 or 6 prints from the Counterpoint series, which is from the color work that took place from 2005 to 2008.
It's a little bit of a retrospective.
That's good.
In a sense, yeah. No, it's really nice.
Are they digital prints?
No. Mm. They're all of the Architect's Brother are either photogravures that were produced with John Goodman in Florence, Massachusetts, or they are large panel pieces that have been painted. Ah. And then the counterpoint work, the color work, those are archival prints on watercolor paper.
You do multitask.
That's right.
And we're just a few minutes left with the two of you. You graciously came to the studio on your way from home to New York City. Thankfully, we're on that road. And then Saturday, you're going to be at the reception.
Yes.
Yes.
CPW. And is there going to be a Q&A?
Yes, there's going to be. I think the reception will take place for about an hour, and then I think we're going to walk around and answer questions that people might have about the work.
I think that's an excellent idea because it's so great to have the authors tell the story to help people, because I think your work is so intriguing and maybe don't like, I don't know, talking about the nuts and bolts that go into the machinery and into the art. Maybe you don't want to give away some of the fantasy. How do you feel about that?
We walk a thin line. I mean, if people want to know certain things, we're happy to share. But I guess when it starts to get too technical, if someone just has too many questions that are pointed in a direction that the rest of the audience just doesn't have the skill set to know what those answers might mean, then we try to steer away from that, not so much because we want to be secretive, but because only a few people in the room are going to understand and appreciate the information. So, and plus, I think it's more interesting to stay talking about the conceptual aspects of mm-hmm. our imagery rather than exactly what we do in the dark room.
Yeah, we love to hear when there's a train. We love to hear what people have to say about our work. The interpretive element is such a satisfying process of making art, I think, is once you make it and then it's out in the world, it's how other people interpret that and see something different in that maybe we were thinking about or maybe not. You know, it brings something new to us, and that, I think, is the most interesting part.
Yeah, I would agree. It's the technical, it's not important, the story, and I think people want to hear the story from the storyteller's point of view. And it's like watching a movie, and it looks like a perfectly normal, no CGI film, and then you find out later that that house wasn't really there, even though it looks like it. And then all of a sudden, the story becomes less about the story, and
right.
And you've lost that magic that was put there in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Exactly.
So just keep it magical.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, that is going to do us for the Art of the Hudson Valley this month. I'm your host, Chad Weckler, and we've had two wonderful guests. Did we mention you're both married?
To each other.
Yeah, yeah. To each other. You know, I'm married, but not to either of you. thank you both
for being here.
Great. And we'll see you at Woodstock this Saturday for the reception. It's a 2-month-long exhibit, which I think is fantastic. And I know CPW is looking forward to having your work up. I'm sure it's up right now, but it's going to be a great show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Well, goodbye, everybody. This has been WGXE.org Radio.